wind howls over a post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, they'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Sheltering in the Cutaway Bunker today is Adrian Salmon, comic book artist and illustrator, and dare I say it, utter legend in the Doctor Who community, as the man behind some of the best strips for Doctor Who magazine. We at Cutaway are lucky enough to have him working for us, and on a personal note, it's been an honour and a pleasure to see his pages come in for my forthcoming story, Sutekh the Heretic. Adrian, welcome.
Hiya. Hi, Ian. How are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good.
Good.
Good to see you. I've met you a few times in real life, each time at the La Cigari in
really?
Manchester, which is the source of all this thing. It's where I got to know Gareth, the pub he used to run, which was adorned with your artwork. I think he has the largest collection of Adrian Salmon artwork in the world.
In Manchester.
At least. I think your work is collected all over, isn't it? But he's certainly got a lot.
Yeah, he has.
All over his flat now.
He trawled my portfolios back in the day. Yeah.
But that's how I know Gareth, from when he was running the La Cigari, through putting plays and things on. It's a theatre pub. But also, I then found out he's a Doctor Who fan. And I started working with him on his conventions, and you were a guest at one of them once. But he even had a room named after you, didn't he?
He did.
The Salmon Room. So I think some of my earliest plays, before I became a professional writer, were performed in the Salmon Room.
Oh, yes, I remember it well.
Yeah, it was tiny.
but it was, wasn't it? My artwork crowding in on everybody around.
It saw some early plays of mine and many other people's. There's quite a lot of people who've performed in the Salmon Room, writing for TV and Casualty and Hollyoaks and EastEnders and all sorts of things.
Right.
That really creative, weird time when we all lived in the pub with Gareth, basically.
Yeah, it kind of became his green room, didn't it, when we had guests there? I remember sitting next to Terence Dix that time.
Yeah.
Terence hadn't... Nobody brought him a drink or something, and he was starting to get a bit edgy, and I think he thought I was a servant or something next to him. It was pretty funny.
Terence Dix, you were.
I was indeed.
Well, it's one of my greatest regrets is I was late that day. I got stuck in traffic and I arrived just in time to gush at Terence Dix as he was getting in a taxi. Never met him. God bless him. Yeah. But obviously we're here because of Gareth Cavanagh of Cutaway Comics, but most of all, most importantly, we're here because of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And you've got your 5 choices that you're going to be that are going to see you through to the end of your natural, stuck in this bunker eating cat food and K rations, whatever it is you end up doing. So I'm kind of going with the order you put them in because I'm not going to ask your name because the internet didn't tell me. I'm 50 years old myself. So Pyramids of Mars, I love, but I have such a vague memory of it. I was so young when it was on. So is Pyramids of Mars that you put first, is that from your childhood?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It is a lot. I mean, I started watching Doctor Who sort of the tail end of Pertwee, middle to tail end, and then sort of Tom Baker became, you know, kind of my doctor, as they say. And Pyramids is great because I'm a huge gothic horror fan, you see. You'll see this, you'll probably pick up on this thread through our talk, and it's I love anything like that, and particularly, you know, Hammer films. I'm a massive fan of those. And Pyramids kind of scratches that itch, but it also has a bit of the modernity of the science fiction aspect to it, which I kind of like, you know. It's sort of, it's the same as my second choice, is the same way. It's kind of mixing the two sort of genres, and making something new. And with Pyramids particularly, it's the design of the mummies, which are quite frankly brilliant. Or the robots, the service robots. I watched it again the other day, and I was like, oh, this is just, it's just fantastic design work, you know. So yeah, that's why it's it sort of goes back. In fact, I remember when DWM used to run that a kind of a little feature thing in the issue about what was your, you know, list your top 10 stories. And Pyramids was my number one at the time as well, and this was back in, I guess, 94 or 95, maybe earlier. And I drew a little picture, which I have no idea where it's gone now, of me being strangled by one of the mummies. So yeah, that kind of gets kind of
somebody out there will have the copy of Doctor Who magazine. And
it's one of the early ones, I guess. Because I started working for them, I guess, in, I think it was about 92, something like that, with the Sidemen. And it was a little bit after that, probably not long though, because everybody was sort of, they were just asking everybody their favorites. And I think Paul Weiss did the illustrations for it, you know, something related to the choices. And I said, oh, I'll do mine, you know. And strangled myself.
we'll have to go and have a look for that. Yeah, I mean, it's that Hinchcliffe era is obviously, those stories are coming up a lot as I do this podcast. And it's an era that's I'm just a little bit too old for, but remember, but as revisiting it, it's become my favourite era.
Right.
I'm of that cusp of, I actually remember more of the era that I don't like so much anymore, which still got me into Doctor Who. But
right.
But it's Talons of Weng Chiang and Terror of the Cylons and all those sort of things that I do remember, but I've, on appraisal, I love them even more than when I was a little kid.
Yeah, it's funny. I watched Chiang again the other day, because sort of once I'd watched Pyramids, it kind of got the old juices going. I thought, I'll break out my box set, the Blu-ray. And I thought, oh, I watch Chiang again and stuff. And it's, apart from the, you know, the yes, apart from the racism. And the fact, I think maybe it's about two episodes too long, but it still holds well. The rat doesn't hold up, but I guess that's kind of part of the charm of it, isn't it, really? I still like Leela in it, because she's my favorite companion. So
yeah, me too.
By a long chalk. And I'd forgotten how abrasive the Doctor was with her in this, and learned afterwards that Tom Baker wasn't particularly keen on the character of, you know, Leela and whatnot. I thought, well, you didn't really hide that, did you, Tom?
I mean, they're friends now. Louise and Tom both say I'll just let the dog stop barking. Edit point. Because we live by a canal. So if anyone dares to walk past on the towpath, then well, live podcasting. Well, it's not live, but the odd part you can put up with. I mean,
yeah,
I will. I'll say this because it might end up being in the podcast. Cause you never can tell what actually sounds quite nice. But I interviewed Martin Geraghty at his home the other day,
and
his dog was on his kitchen floor, just scrabbling constantly, or was on his.
Yeah, it's very, very lively dog he's got.
The photo I took, I realized that was a really good piece of Adrian Salmon art on the board.
Oh, I know, he has it on like a little tripod thing, doesn't
he? Yeah,
he bought it. I met him at a convention, about 92 or 93 or something. I can't remember where it was, Liverpool, I think. And he just came up and introduced himself, and I knew who he was because I'd seen his stuff in that Lunar Cows thing, and his stuff in the mag and stuff. And he bought that one. I thought he bought two pages, but maybe I was wrong. I don't know. It's funny. I never know who's really got these. I mean, actually, when we did the reprinting of the Sidemen last year, or was it the year before, and remastering and stuff. I found out I've got nearly half the pages still, which is amazing because I had them on sale at a shop in London called Showcase, and they had a flood and something or other, and I kind of assumed that I'd got everything back that I had, but a guy called Rufus Dayglow had been in there and been saving people's artwork, and he just got in contact with me. He said, "Oh, I've got some of your stuff," and I thought, "Oh, it'll be just be like Judge Karen stuff from Dread or whatever." I said, "Oh, great!" So I arranged to get it back and opened it. It was like three Simon pages in. I was like, "Oh, okay, that's a bonus." So now I've got like a glut of them.
Oh wow!
I have to get to eBay, won't I?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. A lot of people kind of asked me about buying these those pages, and it's like, well, yeah, I've got a bunch now.
just turn up at Gareth's store.
Yes,
I don't think he's got any wall space left in his flat.
No.
But I'm sure he'll find, put some on the balcony under outside or something under perspex. But so Pyramids of Mars, obviously, obviously it's great that it's genuinely one of your favorites, because it's also Sutek, which both me and Neil are working on for Cutaway.
Well, that's it. That's really interesting. I tell you what's interesting about it as well, to do with Sutek, is that there was in the special extras on the Blu-ray, they were talking to Hinchcliffe. I think it's an old interview, but he was talking about Sutek specifically and how he'd been disappointed in how he'd end up kind of looking, because he was sort of very stiff and whatever.
Yeah.
And
he looks like a mummy.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? And I think he was hoping for something more animated. And I thought, because I know we've had to reimagine how he looks for the comic because of obvious copyright reasons. And
he's Egyptian,
but you know, at the end of the day, exactly, he's set, isn't he? He's like, it's funny, when I was researching it after I got your script, I was like looking at it, and it was like, well, he kind of looks like a dog, jackal, something else. I thought, Christ, he's a bit of a mix of you know, all sorts of stuff. And it's been fun drawing him, it really has. I mean, I'm on the last, literally on the inking that last page now.
Oh wow.
Which I won't say anything about, of course.
No.
Don't want to ruin it for the for the fans.
It's been a pleasure, absolute honour getting that artwork through. It's weird as well, the gap in time. So you're there going, because you put your bubbles on, which a lot of artists don't do, but you've sort of put placeholder bubbles on. So it's really good going, the story flows really well.
Absolutely. Well, it's kind of, it's not something I used to do, but I started when I did Orsini for Gareth for Cutaway.
I'd
got the script from Eric, and bless
Eric Saywood for people.
Eric Saywood. It was, Eric's not a comics writer. He's quite, you know, I'm sure he'd admit that. And he sort of, he kind of overran the page count by about three pages. So rather than us, you know, bothering him to try and sort of shoehorn it together, I thought, well, I'll just have to repaste parts of it and stuff. Because there was some stuff where it was just, you know, one panel would have done for two, you know, and it was that sort of thing, which is quite good fun for me. And I found that actually putting the balloons on, you know, the speech balls, was a good way for me to help pace it and stuff. So I sort of, and it also for our letterer, for Colin, it gives him it's not like a casting iron position, but it's roughly where I'm assuming it'll go. So he just, you know, unless he has a better idea, which he might it'll just, you know, it's just so that I know where the interesting stuff to draw will be seen, and then where the words and which, you know, sort of take the viewer across the page will also be positioned. So that's why I do that. But yeah, it adds a bit of work, but in some ways it doesn't, because it's sort of, you know, it's all part of the, just, you know, the lettering, the sound effects, everything, that's all part of comics. It's not just a pretty picture, you know. It's a graphic design type exercise as much as anything else.
I always agree. There was a fashion in the I'm trying to think when it was, maybe it was the '90s, for like really painterly. I won't name any names because some of them are amazing artists, but it's like you might do for a cover, doesn't necessarily suit panel, you know, doesn't necessarily suit the storytelling. It kind of makes the storytelling sluggish. And
well, yes, it makes you kind of,
there's no dynamism.
Kind of linger a bit, you know, because as you say, the illustrations are so, you know, well, they are the kind of illustrations. I mean, there's different sorts of artists were using paint as well. Anyway, some of them, like say Bill Sienkiewicz in America, he'd be, that was sort of more, you know, kind of moved more.
I wasn't thinking of Bill Sienkiewicz's work, because he's an amazing, he's one of the gods.
It was a thing, wasn't it, for a while there. I tried to do some of that. It's just like, oh god, it's just in acrylics on a big piece of paper. It's just like, god, I'd never get anything finished if you did it that way. It's just,
no. I think that, well, yeah, I think that's maybe why it didn't last very long as a phase. It's like,
it's
a pulp medium. We need this. We need it to come out.
Often. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're ready.
No, exactly. It's something. It needs a bit of sort of streetness to it, I think. Comics. Yeah. Maybe that's just the way I was brought up with comics. I don't know.
Because
the landscape's changed so much in recent years. With graphic novels and all sorts of stuff and ways of doing it, which is great, and of course the advent of digital art as well, which is add another layer to things. But of course computers are going to be doing it for us soon anyway with this AI bollocks. So
What was that Judge Dredd thing that Cam Kennedy illustrated?
Kenny Who, about the Scottish artist.
Always sticks in my head. Now it's like, oh my god, it's almost there.
It is. It's almost reality.
just type in what you want, and the computer will interpret it in an artistic manner.
Give you a character with six fingers and one eye.
Yeah.
Warp. The near-legendary Doctor Who fanzine is back for its fifth issue. As always, it's a sumptuous, glossy, gorgeous feast of goodness, featuring in-depth articles on all manner of Who-related expanded media. Artist John Ridgway and writer Steve Parkhouse discuss their classic Sixth Doctor comic strip, Voyager. And writer Alan Stevens takes us through the history of one of Marvel UK's most popular Whoniverse creations, Absalom Dak, Dalek Killer. There are two full-colour comic strips too, exclusively commissioned for Warp Warp. The Iron Legion returns in a 22-page story written by Lance Parkin and illustrated by Steve Andrew, this time pitting the rampaging Roman robots against the 12th Doctor, while Absalom Dak gets another adventure with the mighty John Ridgway on art duties.
Hey, Chainsaw Silversides!
On top of all of that, there's the full story of how Canadian animation studio, Nelvana, came very close to making an animated version of Doctor Who in the 1990s. As well as interviews with the project's key creatives, we've recorded the pilot script as an audio drama. Accompanying the magazine as a cover-mounted CD, it stars British sitcom legend Arthur Bostrom as the Doctor.
Endless vast wastelands, distant nothingness stretching as far as the eye can see. Not very inviting. Could be Milton Keynes. No, the stars are all wrong. Very wrong indeed.
Continuing our dedication to the printed form, Warp Warp 5 is only available as a physical copy and can be ordered from anywhere in the world for the UK price of £10.99 plus shipping. For more information and to place an order, visit warpwarp.co.uk. The link in this episode's notes will take you straight to the shop. Or, for our overseas readers going to Gallifrey 1 in Los Angeles in February, the Cutaway Comics team will be there with piles of Warp Warp 5s for sale, as well as all our other comic book lines. So, see you in the dealer's room. And the bar.
So, So there's young Adrian watching Pertwee and then Tom Baker and scared of the Pyramids of Mars. How important, obviously everyone's here because we all like Doctor Who, but how important to your overall life and career is Doctor Who? You know, everyone's mileage varies.
I don't think anyone would know my name without Doctor Who, quite frankly. It's been such a pivotal part of my career from, 30 odd years. Mm. I mean, I've worked on Doctor Who stuff in one form and another, whether it's, you know, for the magazine, the Time team, of course, mm-hmm. the comics, right down to doing posters. And I mean, you know, I've got a mug in my hand right now with something I drew on it. I mean, it's the Genesis of the Daleks. I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, it's just.
I've got that T-shirt for my son.
Oh, have you?
Brilliant. Yeah, the 7-year-old wears it. I didn't realize awesome. Until I got it home. It's one of yours.
Yeah, no, but it's been so good to me. I mean, you know, so it's. I mean, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. It's sort of like, you know, my style sort of came alive when I started doing the Doctor Who stuff more than anything. Originally, when I first started trying to do it, I was doing the sort of like kind of Target type cover things, you know, the Achilleos, and like everybody has a shot at that, that's what you people thought of as Doctor Who artwork for so long. Mm-hmm. I remember going to see Gary Russell at a convention at Alexander Palace. He looked at my stuff and he was like, oh, yeah, it's all right. He says, no, you just show me something different. And that was kind of one of the catalysts, you know. So I kind of, about a year later, I'd broken into the magazine finally, mainly from doing this really stark style. I know, I'll draw Cyberman and Master and something else. And I'll go and see if Gary's interested. And Gary really was really great. He was so pivotal in getting me going and stuff, because he said, I mean, first thing he said, well, I can't use it on the main strip, it's just too radical. I was like, yeah, it's cool. But so he found other places to use me, which is brilliant, you know. And then of course the Cybermen came along, he'd got this script, and it kind of just sort of went from there. I mean, part of me has always wanted to do a long session of the strip, the main strip. I don't think I'm the sort of artist that's ripe for that sort of thing, because I think you have to be more like, say, a Martin, more character-driven, if you know what I mean. Sort of with more of a naturalistic touch, even though he's stylized in his own way. And I think that I kind of change all the time. I'm always trying to sort of evolve things. You know, I'm looking for the most successful route I can find. And it always is sort of, because I mean, my favorite artist is Mick McMahon, which you'll probably work out pretty soon.
I was going to say he's an artist who I always think of in tandem with you. Both different, but you share commonalities in abstract. Mm. Maybe kids maybe go, oh, that doesn't look realistic or something.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, I was fully aware that sort of following that line, but I didn't really have any choice because that's what it just felt natural to me to go that sort of route. That's gorgeous. When I was doing the Who stuff, it was just, well, it just, you know, it sort of really stood out. It doesn't stand out as much, I don't think, now as it did, because nowadays you've got lots of sort of very designer type Who illustrations out there. I mean, just go on Twitter. I mean, there's lots of really gorgeous graphic work going, so I kind of feel a bit old-fashioned at times, but I kind of slightly moved away from being so stylized. I mean, the stuff on Sutek is stylized, but I don't think it's as stylized as I could be. I think there's certainly a touch of more sort of, you know, feathering and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I noticed that.
If you know what I mean,
And we've all seen it as well. Your style was slightly different, but I guess it changes from story.
Well,
to story.
Yeah, I'm still kind of playing with the idea that if I did it really, really, really stylized, people would just go, oh, I'm not going to buy this crap. This is terrible. It doesn't look like that doesn't look like a scene. It's ridiculous. What's this rubbish? And you are, as an artist, I mean, any creative artist, writer or whatever, you're always plagued with these doubts that actually, someone's going to find you out and go, no.
Yeah.
I've got your number, mate.
Yeah, well, whatever your instincts are, they've definitely worked with Orsini and Sutek. I mean, with Orsini particularly, you just straight away go, that reminds me of the characters from the telly. Stance, the way he holds himself,
it was great to do that. I mean, there's not much to go on, really. You've got one story and that's it. I was kind of really keen to keep him looking pretty much like he did, but add a few, show his bloody leg for a start. Because that's a comic-y thing, isn't it? You want to see, if someone's got a cybernetic leg, then let's see the damn thing, not hide it under a boot,
Because
we're not encumbered by, a certain budget. We can show stuff like that. So that made kind of sense, And just give him a slightly longer coat. it's always a good one, that.
Slightly longer coat. But giving around and improving action
exactly scenes. That's what it's all about. It's about trying to make the visual so it's more exciting on the page. And that's, I guess, kind of part of the difference between that and the TV show. Though nowadays, one of the things I found on the Time Team was that as we got to the newer stuff, the Russell T Davies stuff and onwards, mm-hmm. I kind of felt redundant because I thought, well, these are so visually oriented, these stories, these images. It's like, what's the point in me bloody drawing them and stuff? And it was much more of a struggle. When I was working on the classic Who or whatever you want to call it, particularly the early ones like the Hartnell and what's names. So there was, sometimes all I'd have was the telesnaps and one of Andrew Pixley's archives with some pictures. That'd be it. And it was great for an artist because then you could just extrapolate and sort of like just make stuff up. Yeah, and that's the best. In the end, that's the best thing is the making stuff up bit.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
and
did they ever collect Time Team together as a volume?
No, they haven't. No.
It's like a good little repository.
Oh yeah, I get asked that at least two or three times every year by different fans. They say, oh, coffee table book like this. And I'm like, yeah, maybe it will happen. I mean,
Panini, if you're listening.
Yeah, it's because they do.
Make a few quid.
They kind of hold the copyright to those images anyway. Because you kind of, when you get paid by Panini, they had one of these sort of clause things where basically when you sign it, you sign away your rights to. It's from Marvel, the work for hire thing. That's what Marvel were doing. So if you don't do that, you don't get your money. And it didn't really bother me, to be honest. But they're pretty cool. Well, if I need to, use them or show them somewhere or do something and stuff, they're really cool about it. You don't get a problem. So.
No.
But I suppose if I made a book, maybe they'd ask.
Yeah. But Time Team reminds me of the first time I did meet you at the La Cigari, I had a play on, and so I had all my actors around a table and my director, and we would and Gareth said, "Oh, that's Adrian Salmon, and he listed all your things, and the last thing he listed was Time Team. Right. My director doesn't know anything about Doctor Who or comics. But he's a mad archaeology fan. And he thought you were the guy who did the illustrations on Time Team.
Victor Ambrose.
Yeah, I remember him bending your ear. Like, and you were just looking amused, looking your pint when he was just going, oh, I love your illustrations of. I don't know if you remember, but then he just slowly dawned on both of you what he meant. And he went, oh, I feel a bit silly now.
Oh no, Victor was fantastic illustrator,
Yeah.
and yeah, I've got
Yeah,
lots of his books anyway, not just the Time Team stuff, but because he did lots of children's books and
didn't he do like Usborne? I can't
yeah, lots of
remember those.
historical stuff, which is another
Yeah.
one of my real favorite sort of topics. Yeah, I saw some of his stuff. We actually vi visited Sutton Hoo, and
I'm going
they
there
had
in 2 weeks.
it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And but they had an exhibition of Victor's artwork on at the time, so it
Oh,
was
wow.
fantastic. So I went to see, saw those in the in the flesh, so to speak. Yeah, but
Wow.
avid Time Team fan.
Yeah. Of both time teams,
Of both time teams, yeah.
yeah, brilliant. Well, I suppose accidentally I've created a great segue to your second choice, which is a massive one of the early historicals at
Yeah.
Hartnell, Battle of Hastings, which is the Time Meddler.
Yes.
So, why is that on your list out of
Well,
all?
apart from the fact it's absolutely brilliant.
Well, yeah, obviously,
Yeah,
all Doctor Who's brilliant, so why does
it's yeah, but
that?
this is really brilliant. Yeah. It's I just love the I love the juxtaposition position of the sort of the historical aspect with the sort of modernity. It starts right at the start before we even see the tape recorder with the Gregorian chanting going on of the monks. It's when there's a close-up of Peter Butterworth as the meddler, and he sort of pulls back his arm to look at, which is obviously a watch on his wrist, and but it's gone. He's dropped it because Stephen picks it up later, and you just know. You know what he's doing. He's looking at a watch. Why is this monk looking at a watch? It's just so subtle but brilliant.
I do think
And
we forget how well written like
yeah,
Doctor Who
yeah,
was right from the off.
it is. And it's sort of it makes it more rather than just being, so we say, a staid sort of just historical story. You know, it's like it brings the it mixes it with the science fiction. The idea he's got this sonic cannon thing, that he's gonna destroy the Hardrada's, fleet with or whatever. And you think, and actually, a part of you thinks, well, it's not actually that bad an idea, is it really? Because then,
Tolkien would approve.
it's
Everything went
just.
downhill after the invasion, the conquest.
Yes, exactly. It's like, yeah, no, you don't meddle with history. But it's kind of a really interesting character, the meddler, the monk, or whatever you want to call him and stuff. I think he only turned up once more, didn't he, in the
The
master
chase,
plan.
the master plan, not the chase. Yeah, the with the Daleks, he was very popular, so they got him back. Yeah.
Yeah, because I thought he was brilliant. He was like a precursor in the way, I suppose, to the master, but he wasn't sort of like really like, evil in that
Yeah.
sense. He was more sort of naughty,
Yeah.
the naughty master. You know,
Yeah.
he was just sort of. I just find it's great, and he's the sets are brilliant. You know,
Yeah.
the Abbey, and it's just sort of all decaying. I suspect that if you did it in color, it'd probably look a bit shabby and whatever. And also the only sort of questionable bits are the fights. They're a bit
Yeah,
lame,
they're like
but.
sub Star Trek,
Yeah,
throwing
but
themselves around.
there's a bit towards the end where the villagers sort of attack one of the Vikings that's left alive and stuff, and they actually kill him, and there's 12 seconds of it was excised. I just wonder with all the swords stabbing in and whatever, because I saw the something of the script, and it was like, and then they kill him and screams and all the rest of it, and
Yeah.
it's pretty brutal. I tell you another brutal bit, which is actually quite, I think, probably passes by a few people, is when the woman played by, oh, she speaks to the doctor early on. She sort of gives him some mead. Anyway, the Vikings basically attack, and when the other characters sort of come back and find her, she's obviously in shock because she's obviously been raped. There's no
Oh, there again.
question on the fact,
Yeah.
and you think, Christ, that's really heavy, because she's in almost a catatonic state, and you think, well, they must have really sort of raped her or whatever.
Yeah.
It was terrible, and you thought, God, it's kind of edgy for a sort of a children's show. This
Yeah.
is really hard hitting stuff,
Yeah, well, I guess Doctor Who's always existed in that, not quite just for children, but children, it doesn't tell children anything they don't already know. And if there's,
but yeah,
if you already know stuff, you don't learn it from Doctor Who, but you pick up on it because you know more about the world. I always think what's really interesting about Time Meddler is, I mean, whenever you watch Hartnell, you're sort of watching the show become itself. Like I had to watch the Aztecs for one of these podcasts, and I'd never seen it before. I'd never got around to watching it. I'd had the DVD on my shelf amongst all the million other things to watch for years.
Yeah.
That's one thing that's great about this podcast is I'm watching things I haven't watched or haven't watched in years. Or sometimes, like, there was a guy I interviewed the other day, a YouTuber. He was brilliant, but all his choices were classic. And I realized I hadn't watched Spearhead in Space since 10 years before he was born.
Right.
And it's just like, wow.
Yeah.
With the Aztecs, you kind of have that thing that, A, you have the violence. It's quite dark, but you do have quite a lot of adult themes going on with people copping off and things like that. And Doctor will never do again. But it's also, that's one where the TARDIS lands, and it's a bit more like, this is more what Sidney Newman had in mind. It's time travelers landing, but they're the only thing that's new. Good about a Time Meddler, and it's kind of got the same DNA as Talons of Wang Chiang in that it has science fiction elements that aren't just the time machine.
It has
this mixture, and that is really, it'd be very strange now to do a Doctor Who that was a pure historical. I mean, when was the last pure historical that didn't have an alien disguised as something but in a way that is Doctor Who, is it's always got to have an extraterrestrial not extraterrestrial, then it's got to have it's a mad earth scientist wouldn't quite cut the mustard.
That's part of its evolution though, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
I mean, it's sort of, I guess it all kind of changed with the Daleks, and that was kind of, you know, suddenly, you know, popularity sort of drives these things. And, you know, people like that and want to see more of it then, you know. But luckily, it's sort of, Doctor Who still seems to be able to kind of manage to straddle the two types of approaches, I find. So sometimes, you know, modern Who sort of tends to somehow kind of hit you with a shovel with the stuff. You know, it's not quite as subtle, but, you know, changing, as they say.
But they also, Doctor Who, there's time for the pendulum to swing all different ways. As Russell T. Davis says, it's the best format, it's the best premise for a TV show ever made. And that's why it's still going. But with the Meddling Monk, obviously we've got Peter Butterworth, who's just amazing. Have you heard any of the sort of other versions of the Monk in Big Finish and the like?
No.
Just because, as a little aside, talking about your Orsini comic when we were at Hooverville, when Rufus Hound was a guest, and he plays the Monk for Big Finish.
Right.
So he came up, and I gave him one of my Demons of Eden that I'd written, and just sort of gave it to him in exchange for a photograph. But then he bought Orsini, one of the last Orsinis in the wild.
Oh, did he?
So he bought a bunch of stuff, and one of them. So he's got his mitts. The Meddling Monk has got his mitts on.
He'll get his sonic cannon out. Yeah, he's destroyed Cutaway.
Oh no, who's that standing behind you? I agree. The Time Meddler is one of those.
It's just resonates with me. I obviously never saw time.
It's one of the reasons I'm going to buy the box set for that for season two, I think.
I haven't got all the Blu-rays. I mean, I've only got one box set, actually.
No,
Tom Baker one. So.
Yeah, I've resisted buying the Blu-rays because I didn't have a Blu-ray player till I realised that PS4s are Blu-ray players.
They are.
No one told me. I was about to buy a bloody Blu-ray player, but I've already had one. So moving on, as we were talking earlier about your Mick McMahon, I always called him Mike McMahon. I'm sure when he was an art droid in 2008,
he was Mike McMahon.
So you picked Junkyard Demon, which I remember so well from when it was in Doctor Who Weekly, wasn't it?
And
I think Neil Gaiman remembers very well, because his first episode of Doctor Who was very much Junkyard Demon influenced, I think. The one with the TARDIS is Saran Jones, but the Junkyard element of it straight away made me go, It's that, I mean, God, the way he draws Tom Baker is just perfect, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's obviously, you know, he's obviously not got a single photograph. He's obviously not. But that's Mick, you see.
Yeah,
because I know him reasonably well, and he wouldn't dream of just sitting there with photographs and trying to work from them like the rest of us mere mortals. He kind of just gets the essence, gets and sort of draws his doctor, so to speak. And by the by the time you finish Junkyard Demon, you know, it doesn't seem odd. You know, it seems just right. And also, it's all about getting the whole world of that strip to work, because you've got these other alien characters and stuff, and they're all really extreme. And so you really need an extreme, doctor image. And it was just it's just stunning. Even the Cybermen, he's obviously they were sort of a bit of this and a bit of that, whatever. But it's just brilliantly done. He actually didn't ink it either, which is kind of rare for him.
Oh, well, really?
Adolfo Baiula, Italian, I think he is. Ain't it? As Mick said, he didn't really, you know, he was fairly pleased with what he did. He didn't take too many liberties or whatever.
Yeah. I remember staring at that artwork for hours. Just something about the lankiness of Tom Baker.
Yeah, I hope Gareth's got a page now, hasn't he?
Hasn't
he?
Yeah.
If I ever go around to his gaff, he may not have that page. Gareth, just turn the other way, mate.
Yeah. put an Adrian Salmon up. Yeah. used to be a
Mick. Junkyard Demon was just such a, because the thing is, you know, and this kind of fits in with the cutaway thing as well, is that I never, the lead strip was generally not my favorite bit. I've nothing against Dave Gibbons, I think he's brilliant, but I always like the backup strips all the time, you know. That was always my favorite bit, and so this kind of feels almost like a cross between a backup strip and the lead, because it's so quirky. You wonder how the hell they decided to run it. Do you know what I mean? Because it must have just really annoyed a lot of.
It's weird because I remember being very young Doctor Who, very young comics buyer, and I used to get annoyed when Mike McMahon was the illustrator for Judge Dredd.
Because
I was an idiot, because I wanted Brian Boland every week.
Yeah.
You know, nothing against Brian Boland. Amazing. But
yeah, absolutely.
A lot easier to like a lot. But then very early on, I was like, oh my God, Slane and all that sort of stuff when he was doing absolutely. And suddenly, you know, when I was five, I was obviously an idiot. And by the time I was 10, I don't think so.
I think that's probably quite a lot of us. I mean, I remember I was an absolute huge Boland fan as well, because you put your finger on it, then he's just so easy to like. Mm. He's got a style that's easy to sort of to love. It really has got a brilliant style. Whereas Mick's was much more punk and stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, for my wishes, I was not a punk. I was just like a regular, you know, kid, really. And so, you know, I at the time, my favorite artists were Brian and John Bolton, who did a lot of stuff for the Hammer magazine. And that sort of luxurious sort of, and it, I could never sort of kind of bring the two together, as the Mick stuff is just so poles apart from those guys, and yet I like both of them, and I couldn't really assimilate that for a long time. And I realized what it was with the people like Bolton and Boland was the grace of the work, the clarity, the simplicity, whereas there was this sort of ragged, annoyed energy about mixed stuff.
I think that's why it was absolutely perfect for Slane. I think it was the first issue I ever bought with my own pocket money. Was hand cover when the Sky Chariots and Slough Feg. You know,
it was insane.
People with antlers and massive antlers.
I mean, it's kind of insane. It is an insane strip, that, really. It's sort of, it shouldn't be as good as it is. It's just how did he do that? And sort of, there's stories about how he was lost his confidence and started inking on tracing paper, and you know, when he was using the pen, he was little lines were missing, and that sort of woodcutty sort of style appeared. And then he thought, "Oh, I'm onto something," which is usually the way with anything. It's by accident, and he sort of then started doing it that way on, I guess, on paper and stuff.
Woodcuts for a thing about.
And of course, he's a huge history fan as well.
Yeah,
Celts and everything. He wouldn't have needed any bloody reference. I'll tell you that. He could have just. He just knows. He's just so into history. So that would have been the perfect strip for him.
Yeah, I think it shows. I think it was.
Absolutely.
It's the best run of Slane by far, I think.
Oh yeah, it's my favorite as well. But it's just you know, no slight on Fabry and. And Bellardinelli as well, and of course,
I always for some reason this era is just really crystal in my mind. What was it, Dragon Heist? And then steal a dragon.
And of course, the first episode was drawn by Angie Kincaid, which was Pat Mills's.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
yeah. So you know, Pat always has to make sure everybody remembers that.
But that era. Mm. Of it, because I couldn't remember. It was prog 354, and it was my first prog. I'd looked at loads of them at my cousin's house. He had like a tea chest full of them, which I inherited later on, and then my mum then sent the tip when I was at university. but my first one I actually cycled and to the nearest shop and bought with my own money and actually owned was 354.
That's the key.
And I didn't miss an issue. I didn't miss an issue till the 90s.
Yeah, that's the key bit is the cycle bit. I cycled for the first issue. So, because I'm a little bit older than you. Well, I'm 59. So, I've got 9 years on you there. So, fully remember the first issue coming out. It was just really good seeing British artists, because I was collecting American comics by then anyway. But just to see this product, because I was, before that, the only British stuff I got was my grandfather used to get us the Victor, loads of war stories and whatnot, running to Alf Tupper and God knows what.
I used to have lots of look and learn that from another tea chest when we moved into a house, which was from before I was born, and this was like this magical. Yeah. Trident Empire and adverts for adverts for Gerry Anderson stuff and all that. So I grew up not really knowing much about, not even being interested with American comics because of 2000 AD came straight into my brain.
Absolutely.
And I still am not that bothered by superheroes. Never have been.
I
love comic books.
Well, I got allured by
superheroes.
Yeah, Spider-Man Comics Weekly was the one for me.
Yeah.
I was at school. It was like, you know, this was my first time I saw Steve Ditko's work and Jack Kirby and stuff. And there's just no way that's in my DNA as well. It's always going to be, you know, this early formative stuff at a certain age. They say that, don't they? I forgot what the age is. You know, it's 13 or 14. It just, you know, and move on from there, really.
Yeah, I always think it's more like 10. I've got this theory that it's
right.
Who you are at 10 is kind of 10 to 11 to 12.
Actually, that's actually more right. Yeah, because I'm
and then adolescence comes along and you pretend to be someone else for about till you're about 30, and then you start going, "Oh, that stuff! I wish my mum hadn't taken all my 2000 ADs down."
I know.
And suddenly you're there and you're 15. You're actually doing the stuff that you liked when you were
completely
10.
Regressing into
which is fine. You actually more yourself, but
exactly.
Yeah,
you don't care what anyone thinks. That's why.
I think that maybe that's all we lose between 10 and 40. He's giving a shit what other people think. but with 2000 AD and sort of Marvel UK, that crossover is something that, and some everyone will be listening to this will be a Doctor Who fan, but they may or may not know much about the comics. But that very UK comic scene. So a lot of artists and a lot of writers, you know, are crossing over between, you know,
from
Warrior as well, obviously with the Des Skin connection, Des founding Doctor
Who. Yeah, absolutely.
And Warrior, And again, he's another person that's sort of fundamental to the cutaway story through Gareth, his backup strips. But you've obviously drawn a lot of Judge Dredd and AD as well in your time.
So. Well, I probably worked them for about a year and a half, to be honest. I did a couple of Judge Karen sort of. I did two series of that with John Freeman, and then I did a series with Paul Cornell, another Doctor Who connection, which was a kind of Elizabethan Doctors thing, Death Watch. And I did a bit more with, but again, it's the editor at the time, David Bishop. There was a lot of friction. People didn't like, in the letters pages, you learned that people didn't like what you were doing, and it was pretty demoralizing. So you start to sort of think, well, what can I do to make them like me? I'll change myself, it's always a bad move that. So you start sort of losing confidence in what you're doing. You start sort of, you become neither fish nor fowl. There was a period where I was trying to do stuff like bloody Image comics. It's just dreadful shit, I was just doing awful work. And it really got to a point in the end where I was just like, we don't need anything more from you. It was just, but with Doctor Who and to some extent in the DWM strip, I had the same problem, because they try and gas me to, add more texture and detail and stuff like that. And we're talking about the same issue here of there not being enough. It's just too stylized. But then they realized after they got me to do that actually that was a really bad thing to do, because just every time I try and add too much extraneous stuff, it just turns to crap, really. So it's been a limiting on my career, I suppose, but also it kind of defines what I do at the same time. So you sort of like, oh yeah, it's that guy that does that bloody stark stuff. At least people know.
Yeah, you know an Adrian Salmon when you see one, which other comic book artists could be a lot more interchangeable. Should we get to do this strip? Well, these people, they all draw in quite a similar way. Won't scare the horses. So so I'd rather be an Adrian Salmon and a Mike McMahon.
You tend to find I tend to find people that like my work, the people that buy it, that they really like it.
Yeah.
It's on a really, intense level. So, that's great. I mean, it's kind of what you want, but you just wish more publishers.
Yeah.
I had a similar thing, but I understand, the commercial side of stuff. So, but that's a good thing about working for Cottaway and Gareth and stuff. He just lets me do what I want.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's it's sort of style-wise. I always try to be as true as I can to the writer's story. I really do try not to, I just try and follow the script, because I'm not a writer. They say, people have told me, you should write stuff. It's just like, it's just not my thing, words, because, you've got to be able to play with words and write realistic dialogue, not sort of card comic book dialogue, which is what I would do. It's not something I've trained myself for. I'm not really interested in doing it. That's why I'd just rather just draw.
I tell you what, as a writer, you do not want to do it if you're not into it, because
that's what I mean.
It's
exactly.
Sitting and typing, and it's very. I remember in TV world, a producer who wasn't. It wasn't very erudite producer. He just said, "God, I'm glad someone else does the writing, because it looks so fucking boring."
Right.
And he's like, he's kind of not wrong in his very gauche kind of way.
Yeah.
You're doing something that's a bit like, I guess, like sitting at the piano and practicing every day, or sitting at your art board and drawing every day. If you're not into it. it's not great.
It's like anything, you have to be able to train yourself to draw when the muse isn't there, right? Or I assume write when the muse isn't there, or write yourself into it, or draw yourself into it. Sometimes it'll take a bit for me to get into the zone, so to speak. And when you're in the zone, you can just you just plow through stuff, and then afterwards you kind of come down off it, you know?
Yeah, with writing, you, I mean, I guess it's the difference between a pro and a, and, just, a and an amateur is if you only do it when you're, if you only do it when it's fun, then it's you're not a pro. And sometimes one of the best things you kind of can feel satisfaction because, you know, something will be printed and you'll go, oh God, I was embarrassed by that one. That was I really churned that one out. And then you'll read it a month later and go, oh shit, it was all right. Oh yeah, it's because I'm a pro. And feel good about yourself because you felt intense self-loathing while you were doing it. And
you exactly.
Now you went, the automatic side of your brain still a piece of work. And that's the difference, I guess. Can you do it quickly enough to earn money and good enough even if you're not in the
I mean, you know, a tight deadline can actually be really good. I've had jobs which are over the weekend jobs, you know, and then maybe three or four illustrations, and there's just no time to start second guessing yourself. You just go for it and you just sort of, you just bash it out and you, but in the same way, you're not bashing it such, you just sort of dipping into that memory you've got of how to do this stuff quickly. And you think, right, you know, this is the way you do it, this is the way you do it. It just helps clarify the mind every so often. It can be quite tiring. I mean, how long have I been working on Sutek now? Probably, God knows. When did I start it? I can't even remember.
I don't know. We got
The war
in Ukraine gave us a bit of extra time because the paper
shit. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I Sutek isn't something I could have drawn like over the weekend, put it that way.
No.
So thanks for all the armies there, Ian. Cheers.
Oh yeah. I know. It's just the way the story went. You have to sort of write it and go, if I'm gonna start second guessing what people are worried about, then
that's absolutely the last thing you need to do is worry about what.
But I did think when I was writing armies, I did think of because I'd worked with Martin on Demons of Eden, and he was saying, oh, some writers, you know, it's good it's in a jungle with like a few characters, because some writers, they write, you know, you get there and you get the script and it's a bloody page of, it's a market scene and it's got a million different people and it's going to be there a week on one page.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, well, I will listen to you, Martin, then I'm going to draw a script with lots of armies in it.
Because
you have to switch, in a way you have to switch that part off because it's Sutek, and it was an intergalactic war was the sort of
the brief
I kind of agreed with. And like, well, if we don't have any armies and lots of different alien species, then it's story demanded. But it looks amazing. I can't wait for people to see it.
I had to just sort of because it's not that, you know, in many ways the Sutek stuff and the god stuff and the big stuff, that suits me. But as I say, that again, I'm going to go back to the armies, and don't take this as a criticism at all. the drawing that sort of stuff. I remember when I read the script, I thought, "Oh my God, I can't do this. This is mad. I can't. I've not got the right style for it." And then I thought about it. So I started thinking about Frank Bellamy's Heroes of the Spartan, and that sort of stuff where they did, and even Frank Miller's 300, you know?
Mm.
And I thought, you can do the, I thought there's a way of doing this and being stylized. You don't have to draw every time you have to show, you know, there are lots of ways of showing armies without drawing every buckle, you know? Because that wouldn't have suited my style, you know?
Now you say Frank Miller's 300 is a brilliant sort of...
I thought, oh no, this is quite a good challenge, you know?
Yeah.
And I sort of...
Yeah, and also because it is sort of Egyptian god, so we always had that sort of classical feel to it, fused with a sort of Trigen Empire TV-21, Flash Gordon, lots of different races.
There was lots of stuff to make up. That was great.
But then that sort of classical thing really fits in as well. So now I think you've done a.
I mean, the only thing I missed really is because there's no kind of human beings.
No,
I realized I've not been drawing human beings now for months. I just realized the other day, and I was like,
it's quite unusual in the run of Gods and Monsters. It is the one that is the most alien because obviously you tend to, in most science fiction, ground it with someone from contemporary Earth or someone human, but this is the most out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
The way it was a bit like, I kind of thought, as I'm writing it, this is a bit like Dalek TV-21 stories, which had no humans in them.
Yeah.
You know, Dalek, a story following the Daleks. In ours, we have a story following Sutek.
And lots
of mad things. And I didn't want to have any humans in it because the whole point was we're in a galaxy so far removed from where we even usually see things in the Doctor Who universe, let alone from the point of view of Earth. If we brought any humans into it, it would take us out of that madness. The whole idea is this is like beyond the observable universe from where we're sitting. It's a galaxy we can't even see with our best technology.
I can't wait to see where it goes from.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you'll be drawing a cover, but yeah, the Gareth's main goal was to have Omega and Sutek duking it out. So that's what I'm building towards. Is Eldrad is involved as well, and Sutek, and Omega. And the Omega and Sutek are going to be on the side of a volcano having a big fight. And that's basically what it's...
You and volcanoes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I love a volcano. We've already had it in mind that, like, one of the variant covers will be you drawing...
Oh, that's cool.
Drawing Sutek again.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you. On you! On you!
Coming soon from Cutaway Comics, Phase 1 of an epic new saga, Gods and Monsters. Issue 1, Faustine. Princess of Tharin, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh the Heretic, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega Eltrala, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space. Coming soon. Follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe or visit cutawaycomics.co.uk.
So on to your next choice.
Yes.
Which is talking of 2000 AD and the UK Marvel Doctor Who crossover, your next choice, which is also on Gareth's list, actually, so I've talked to Gareth about it, is Black Legacy.
Yes.
By Alan Moore.
I know. It's fantastic. It's me and Gareth, Black Legacy, we can bore for Britain on it, I tell you. It's just a great it's only 8 pages, that's surprising. It's only 2 pages a month, wasn't there? It was because I reread it in the actual comic the other day, and just to have Blood of my ancestors, and it's just this idea that this ultimate weapon is just sitting there. It's killed its masters, and it kills the Cybermen, and then you see that the Sontaran ball thing coming down, and me and Gareth always said, "Oh, we need to do the next bit. That needs to be illustrated. We have to do what happens next." Yeah. But I'm going to assume that what happens next, too. Yeah. Yeah, because this thing doesn't want to sort of,
wants to get off the planet, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't, no. And there's sort of... Also sort of interesting, what did the Gothsmiths look like? Because you see that skull one of the Cybermen picks up, it's got, like, tusks.
Yeah.
It's a bit sort of Edgar Rice Burroughs, what they call Barsoom or whatever. I forgot.
So, well, that's one of Alan's things, isn't it? Because he brought all that into...
Yeah,
I think he brought all that into his League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, didn't he? So,
yeah, exactly. And also that big sort of monolith thing in the background was taken from I've forgotten what it's called. There's a famous etching that he gave to David Lloyd to make a copy of, which is what the Colossus thing at the back that sort of stands there, sort of looming over the city is taken from. And stuff. I always thought that was really impressive. Because of course, and this is the thing for me. I mean, the first reason I would have liked it would have been David Lloyd's artwork. I always loved Lloyd's stuff, you know. And I, my first encounter with it really was in the Doctor Who backups, you know. And it's still probably my favourite of his work. I mean, I attended the Cartoon Centre used to do when I was living in London. They used to do a monthly meeting, and he'd do a kind of teaching thing, and we'd go there and stuff. And so I got to know David quite well. I mean, we never really saw eye to eye very well.
Well, I met David Lloyd once for V for Vendetta.
Yeah.
And he was next to Joel Silver.
Right.
Who was keeping him in check. And then I was sort of going, interviewing him in this hotel room.
Yeah.
And I mentioned, oh, I know Alan Moore. And everyone, and Joel Silver looked ready to kill the publicist. and David looked a bit shifty, and it was a bit... Well, yeah. Anyway, I love the film, and, you know... I didn't actually particularly like the film, but but I actually love the bloody comic. But I'd interviewed Alan a lot about V for Vendetta. Yeah. I think my quote of what he thought of the Wachowski, because he's really pissed off that they got hold of his number and phoned him up, and he had to give them, you know, he had to tell them, I don't want to speak to you, I'm not interested. Hollywood,
yeah,
fuck off. And then he was sort of telling me, I read the script, someone got the script to me, and it was one of the Yeah, I think he said it's the most execrable piece of dog shit I've ever seen, and things
That's
like that.
Right.
And then I did ask Joel Silver, because he'd just done that thing at the press conference of just making up that Alan Moore had like given his blessing and stuff, when Alan actually dipped out on God knows how much money, which had gone to David, to not have his name anywhere on it. So I sort of asked Joel Silver about that, and the atmosphere was not great. but I also got to meet John Hurt that day, and Stephen Fry, which is much 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 nicer. John Hurt is one of the loveliest men you could ever meet. But anyway, I digress. I'm not here to talk about me. So Black Legacy. One thing Gareth did when we were talking about it was he said he commissioned you when you were really busy to do that cover for Warp.
Yes.
Warp of the, what's the head Cyberman called?
Maxell,
yeah. To do the Blood of My Ancestors cover, which is just gorgeous. I think Gareth's got the original, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. Yeah, that was kind of stipulated right at the start before I even started. Oh, by the way, I'll be buying this, so whatever it is. And it's it's based on the Gareth knows which buttons to press with me, so I'm so easy, putty in his hands. And he sort of he said, oh yeah, there's a Two Fisted Tales cover from EC Comics. Now, I'm a huge EC Comics fan, which were a company in the 50s that did all those horror comics that got banned. Basically,
again, there's a lot of DNA with that, because Des Skin was
exactly
stuff, wasn't he? Came into the backup strips of Doctor Who.
Exactly. So Gareth sort of said, there's this, the one by a guy called Harvey Kurtzman. I thought, oh yeah, perfect. I knew my resistance just crumbled, you know, immediately. I was like, yeah, I can do it. It's funny. It was, I think I was probably busy doing the, working on one of the animations, the BBC at the time. You know, you can't really say no, really. It's just, I just couldn't say no. Because the thought was, oh no, someone else will do this. No, that cannot happen.
No.
It must be mine.
Always framing first.
Yeah, yeah.
So remember, he got you to do the Halo Jones poster for... When we did the Halo Jones, Ballad of Halo Jones stage play, which I co-adapted.
Right.
And he got you to do the poster.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful. And then he was speaking to Ian Gibson at some later date, and he went, why didn't you ask me? I always phone Adrian. Ian Gibson's like, I'd have done it. Maybe next time we adapt Taylor Jones, we'll see.
Absolutely. He would have understood what the spaceship looked like, because I was looking at all his pictures, and I was like, I just don't understand this. Is it called Clara Pandy? Yeah, I just didn't. I was like, it breaking my brain just looking at it. God, you know, what is this thing? you know. But even though I have, stuff. You know, it's again, it's another really good story by Alan Moore. And it is very nice. It's Ian Gibson. I say it's my favourite stuff of Ian Gibson, but to be honest, I think I might be Robohunter.
Yeah,
it's a bit of an old school with that guy.
I love Ian Gibson's artwork.
But
I think maybe the mixture of story and art is got to be Halo Jones for me.
Oh well, yeah, it's like the defining thing in it, really.
Yeah, you know, I think his work on Book Three,
which
is just, you know,
yeah,
like he had a lot more time to do it.
Yeah, he's got a fascinating style. It's sort of, you know. But as you say, he can be sort of, he can kind of look like he's just knocking it all out. That when he, and some of that stuff he did that for 2000, I think he had a different name, C Twerk or something. And it was not up to quite, it didn't seem to be up to quite the same standard as some of the other stuff, I guess. But, you know,
that might just be a dead one.
Artists, it's, exactly. There's lots of reasons for, you know, sort of deadlines, as you say. Maybe you've got, maybe he's got another job on. Sometimes the problem with being an artist, or I guess any kind of freelancer, is that inevitably you get one or two jobs at the same time. You know, and you have to sort of say, okay, yes, I can manage this. No, I can't, because the last thing you want to do is screw up someone's deadline. But in the same breath, you've got to make a living. You know, I think, you know, it's not very linear, you know. It's just you do one job, then you do another, then you do it. It's not like going to work somewhere and you just do, you know. It's kind of strange like that. It's sort of, it can be mental for a while.
Yeah, to bring us on to your last choice, we've got The Body Snatchers by Mark Morris, which I've actually started reading. It's a cracking read, which is, it's not, I mean, there's so many Doctor Who books. And it's not something I've dipped that much into, just like a lot of people haven't dipped that much into the comic book side of stuff. But why did you pick The Body Snatchers? It's a sort of Eighth Doctor story from not long after the TV movie, I think.
It kind of, again, it ties in with the old gothic horror thing. Mm-hmm. I just like the idea. The moment I read the back of it or something about, you know, Victorian London factories, folk, smoke, and, you know, and body snatching, and then Zygons, I thought, oh yeah, this is going to be great. And it was. Yeah. It was. I mean, I haven't read it myself again for maybe, God, 20 years probably, but I still remember it. I mean, it inspired me to do that. Picture of an illustration of a Zygon in front of like factories with smoke reeling out, and I sent it to DWM just as a, you know, used to do that sort of thing to try to generate work, and I never heard anything more of it until an issue turned up, and there it was on the cover. They'd used it as a,
oh wow,
and then they said, you know, invoices or whatever and stuff, and it was an amazing surprise. It was, and that was just completely, but that was all from, that was just me just tipping the hat and to Mark's great book. And in fact, I sent him a print of it last year. He didn't realize that illustration was based, that it had been, that would been the inspiration for it and stuff.
Oh, so you didn't draw the cover for the Body Snatchers book?
No, I just drew it. Yeah, this is back when I was young and I used to have energy to just draw. I used to do this a lot. I just come up with ideas and just draw them. I mean, that's where the Croton comic strip I drew came from.
I did
that because I was so dissatisfied with what I was working on that I did Croton's duking it out with Sontarans, and I did about two pages of that, or three, and I showed it to them at DWM, and they said, oh, this is really good, but can you kind of, you know, can you write the rest of it and we'll get it dialogued? Scott Gray kindly kind of fixed a bit of the dialogue for me, you know, because writing it, I was, at the time I was working, didn't have a lot of work on, so I was driving a van. I was working for a newspaper, so I'd be pulling up at like the red light and writing dialogue down on the seat next to me, and it's all sort of chaotic like that.
The reality of our lives when you think, oh, you're creating all this wonderful stuff, and the reality of life is
no, no, no. It, You know, whenever I'd had a sort of downtime and I didn't have any work on, I'd sort of be kind of generating my own stuff. I don't get to do that very often nowadays. Not because I don't have the time, it's just I'm too bloody slow now and too old, I guess. I mean, not to be a downer, but I was treated for cancer about in 2016. And so that really sort of the aftermath of that has really slowed me down quite a lot, you know, from the chemo and everything and stuff. I mean, fingers crossed, touch wood, I've been discharged, so I'm good. But it sort of made me reassess life in general, you know, and what I was doing and why I was doing things. And I realized I just didn't want to just do everything. I just, you know, I'd rather just do stuff that I really wanted to do. But on the physical side, I'm just not as quick as I used to be. I mean, not that I was ever that bloody quick anyway, but I did come up with this sort of simplified style for a reason, you know. Get stuff done.
I know what you mean. But was it not called the soul of a Cyberman then? The
No,
Croton.
that was where Croton was first created. That was back in the one of the backup strips. And that
Oh, I
was
see.
and that was drawn by, I think it was written by Steve Moore
Oh, right,
and drawn by Steve Dillon. And the character, it kind of ended up drifting in space, and I sort of started him in oh, that was it, Unnatural Born Killers. The title of the strip I drew was called. And that brought Croton back into the Doctor Who sort of comic strips, and
Oh, I
then
see.
uh,
And the Glorious Dead and all that.
and then he got written into, yeah, we did Company of Thieves, which I drew, and Scott wrote, and then Glorious Dead, and Martin was drawing him, and that's why he ended up on in the TARDIS. So and all that came from basically me just having a bit of fun on But
And
that's kind of how stuff happens a lot, or at least it used to. I don't know how it is now, but it's
well, I
sort of.
mean, I don't know. Maybe the spirit is again the cutaway. Gareth's definitely drawing on the spirit from you guys, you and Des and people and the whole era, and like the whole of Gods and Monsters, which is now a 12-issue epic, but the tech is one issue. Came from right. We've got Bob Baker, Omega, and we can have Sutek because no one owns him, and we've got Eldrad because it's Bob Baker. But it basically, it came down to I want it to end with a do what you want, but I want to end up with a punch up between a Marvel style punch up between Sutek and Omega on a mountain.
Awesome.
So it sort of does come from sort of pub chat and Gareth,
Well,
years
that's
and
what
years of building on this thing that we just love, and then it becomes a business and it
I
becomes
mean,
life,
it was.
livelihoods, and
Yeah.
it's all the purity is there. It's just we want something that if it pleases Gareth, because he's good at coming up with stuff, it doesn't. If it pleases him, chances are that means he's hit on something that's going to please a lot of like-minded people. And cutaways proving to be that way, I think.
I mean, that's when we were working on the Cybermen, when I was working Alan Barnes. A lot of the time we did a lot of sort of we'd go to the pub after I'd dropped off a page or whatever and stuff, and you know, we'd come up with ideas or suggestions for the next one from that, you know. I mean, you know, and we'd go back to the offices and trying to sell the idea to Gary, you know. Many times completely pissed. I mean, that's where I think we decided to do Junkyard Demon 2 for a start. I mean, you know, those sorts of things. And they're all from pub meetings. But yeah, I'm sure that 2000 AD that lots of stuff just dated and began that way. I mean, it's just people socializing and talking. It's not sort of people sitting there at home writing pitches and sending them in. And you know, sometimes it's just
No, I mean,
people going, oh, what an idea here. And you go, actually, it's pretty good,
yeah,
you
that's the
know?
thing with Gareth. I've never sat down and had a story conference. We've never like scheduled a meeting. We've just sort of chattered with a mixture of real life and social media, and then the amount of times we've just been out socializing to watch a movie, and then drinking and chatting, or it's like ended up outlining the whole of Gods and Monsters because we were just chatting, but
That's it.
we didn't sit down and have a story meeting. Like
No.
when I have story meetings for TV or whatever, it's like, okay, but in a way. Yeah. It's like, you have to have this meeting because then everyone goes away. Does
right
done with it by chatting in pubs with their mates, and then going back to a
yeah,
meeting.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. But that's the way. That's the way it is. It's just, I think, you know, I always find that ideas just come when they come, and that's it. You know, you can try and stew on them, and you can try and force them, but you know what it's like. You suddenly go, oh yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, and it's the same with when you're drawing and stuff. When I'm trying to come up with a concept for illustration, if it's not happening, I'll do something else for a bit, and suddenly go, oh, it's bloody obvious. I should have done it. And then off you go, and it's.
Yeah, I tell you, the one time we did have a story meeting by Zoom, we all got round and we decided to sort of see if we could do Gods and Monsters as an actual meeting. And we kind of came up with something that was so by committee. and we kind of went away and somebody said, it's kind of like Time Lord Victorious, but not as good. And we'd accidentally come up with some lame idea that somebody had already come up with anyway. And I went, oh, do you know what? I'm kind of glad, because I was feeling that was a week. That wasn't great anyway. So I'll come up with something by chatting to Gareth and not trying to force it.
Yeah.
And then we've ended up with a mad idea involving a time hopping spaceship that, you know, that Mark Griffiths came up with, fused with one of my ideas, and it's all organic and feels more original because
nobody
could have sat down and come up with that idea, those bunch of ideas, because it was all just things randomly clashing.
Yeah.
And us going, yeah, that works. So it's almost like someone else has invented it. And then that's real then, doesn't it?
It's, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant. But I'll tell our listeners that even though it's you didn't do the cover for it of the Body Snatchers, it's a cracking read. It's got a definite talent of Wang Chiang.
It has.
Feel
yeah.
to it. I think it even crosses over a bit, doesn't it? Like
hints
at the Fourth Doctor's down the road kind of thing. At the same time, it's a brilliant little. It's a really atmospheric hint.
Yeah, it's quite pulpy, isn't it?
The Vera 8 Doctor story, I would say.
Yeah, it's quite pulpy and stuff, but it's sort of, you know, I mean, you know, it suits the Mark Morris's stuff, though, because he predominantly writes horror, doesn't he, really?
Yeah.
I think he wrote Toadie, and he's written loads of stuff. He even adapted a Hammer film for when they were doing the books. He did Vampire Circus, and he sort of updated it. Made it completely different than, I guess, the film, but that's okay, you know?
Yeah.
But,
he's got a copy of the... So when they put your cover on the front, was it sort of to tie in with... Mark's book coming out?
No, I don't think so.
Or did they just go, oh, that's good.
I think they just kind of, I think they put it, it had a strap line of destroy all monsters. So there must be some feature inside about the monsters.
That's a good Hammer looking.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, anytime there's an artwork cover on DWM's, always a time for a bit of celebration, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I've been lucky. I've had two. The other one was the Tomb of the Cybermen, which actually started out life as a time team. And Clayton Hickman at the time said, you know what, this is too good for the time team. We should put this on the cover. It's kind of not the right shape. And he said, well, what can you do? So I had to kind of repurpose it and stuff. And it ended up as a cover, which was pretty amazing, really.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, it's so that was pretty cool. I'm really pleased. I mean, I think the Zygon one came up in the top 50 covers ever from DWM. I thought, I can live with that, you know?
Yeah. I'll have to go, and I'm sure we'll find it on the internet and stick it on the socials when we're publicizing this. But
I can send you a what's her name? JPEG or whatever.
Oh, yeah, well, I'd love that, just my own personal.
Well, if I ever see you, I'll give you one of the prints.
Oh, well, have you got some prints, have you?
I've got a load of A3s done up and stuff, yeah.
Oh, wow, it sounds like a brilliant one, yeah. I love Zygons.
Another one of my friends.
I was going to say you're in the Zygon book, aren't you?
I am. Paul Cook, who's a big collector of my work and stuff, and a good friend and stuff. has got me drawn. I probably draw more Zygons than Cybermen, actually, in the end of the day.
Adrian Salmon, it's been an absolute pleasure, and we'll carry on chatting over Zoom.
Yeah, it'd be great.
After this podcast is finished. But thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
That's cool. I will I will stop recording. Although every time I do that, stop recording, someone goes and says something really interesting. So maybe I won't. But
I'm just doing mine off.
Yeah, well, don't worry. I'll keep mine on just in case there's some amazing stuff. But generally, we're off the record.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by James Stevenson of Babylon Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter @cutawaycomics.